more heads coming from them.
I'm going to collect that. The quiz is coming, collect. The extra, so there are extra quizzes. Let me take those. You can use the iPad for notes, yeah. You guys have not got the quiz yet, right? So there's a few more coming. Hey, how are you? Yeah. Just two. Pass it back there. Yeah. Don't start yet. So who doesn't have a quiz here? Everybody have a quiz? Okay. What are you looking for? I'll just throw them on the side. It's okay. They become worthless in about 30 minutes. So everybody has a quiz, right? So you wrote your name on the back. Now turn it over and write your name on the front. Make sure it's the same name. That is now the official clock for the class. We've got 30 minutes based on that clock. So when it gets to 4:01:54, we'll be done. So good luck. Try to keep your work on the quiz itself, but if you have to scratch out and do it on a fresh sheet of paper, don't worry about it. You can just slip it in the middle. Excuse me, if you've got a phone that's buzzing or doing whatever it's doing, could you do something to it? Yeah. Okay. Thank you. got about 10 minutes left. Thank you. about 2 minutes left. Okay, time is up. Please hand your quizzes in towards the end of each show. Doesn't matter which end, just hand it in towards the end of each show. Time is up. Stop writing. Time is up. Folks, time is up. Don't try it anymore. Okay? You got that set as well? Okay. Any quizzes? Okay. Get settled in, folks. We're going to have class in a couple of minutes when people, and I'm giving the 260 people a chance to come back here. Okay. So while we're waiting, were there any surprises? What? Not right now. I'll tell you why. Okay, folks, get settled in, please. Here's what's going to happen. The people in 260 will straggle in, will start class. But Sam and Courtney are in the other room, and one of them is going to come and collect the quizzes from here. And while we're doing class, they're going to sort them alphabetically. So when I get back to my office at 4:45, there'll be a stack. Folks, stop talking. Please, right? There'll be a stack alphabetically sorted, and I'll start grading at about 4:46, 4:47, and I won't stop grading till I'm done, so which will be soon. I will not give you the solutions or access to the solutions till I finish grading, and here's why. If you saw the solutions now, many of you will have meltdowns and freakouts because if it doesn't match exactly what you got, you're going to say, oh my God, I'm going to get a zero on the quiz. Okay? And that's not necessarily true. You might be heading for a zero, but you know, if you took a wrong turn at the last step, you're going to get most of the credit. So I am a I will look to see, because what I'm looking to see is, you know, did you get the basic process? Did you just make a mistake? And I will punish you at the scene of your first crime. You know what I mean by that? If you make a mistake early and it carries through, I won't be doing multiple punishments. But I have a layer of crimes that I have in my hierarchy. So depending on the magnitude of the crime, the punishment will differ. Incidentally, you probably already realized talking to your neighbor that you both didn't have the same quiz. It was technically the same quiz. The wording was the same, but the numbers were different. Why? Because I believe in honesty, but I also believe that there are some among us who tend... I mean, it's so easy to, even if you don't intend to glance over at the next person. So your neighbor's quiz was not the same as yours, which might leave you with an unexplainable problem if you did the wrong thing. I remember when I say this in my class, people say, but that is so tricky. I said, what's tricky about it? You had a quiz in front of you. Do your damn quiz. What does it matter to you what the person next to you is doing? Okay. There was a semester where I got the perfect solution to the wrong quiz. That is really difficult to explain away. So hopefully none of you copied full scale from your neighbor, because you then gave me the solutions to a quiz that was not yours, and none of the numbers are going to match. I don't think any of you would have done that. You look like honest people, so no. So I will, when I'm done, and record it. The reason I asked you to write the names in the back is very simple. Tomorrow or day after, probably tomorrow, more likely. So sometime during tomorrow, you will get an email from me saying, come and get them. And the quizzes will be on the 9th floor of KMAC, right outside the finance department, face down. Now you can see why I asked you to write your name on the back, right? Go take your quiz. It'll be in alphabetical order, right? Go take your quiz out. Don't browse. You know where your name is in the alphabetical order. Just take your quiz out. Don't look at other people's grades. No, there's no other way I can return these quizzes. I can't return them in class because that'll waste an entire class. And that way you'll have to wait till, you know, Wednesday to get it. You will get it tomorrow. Just pick it up. And there will be, I will send you also the solutions to both quizzes in that email with a grading template. So you'll see what you lost points for. You can check your score against it. And I can promise you, I make lots of mistakes grading. Why? Because, you know, at some point, like 9 o'clock, I'm watching Netflix and grading. If something happens on Netflix, I might screw up. Something that pisses me off usually will make me go off in the wrong direction. So if you see a mistake in the grading, don't take it to the TAs. They have absolutely nothing to do with this. You will have to come and talk to me. If you've been avoiding that all semester, you can't avoid it much longer. So if you have a problem with the grading, come by and talk to me. Question?
Can we see our grade on online class?
I'm sorry?
Can we see our grade on?
You will, but there'll be a lag because once I've graded and recorded in my spreadsheet, I will hand it to the TAs to record. So you will probably know your grade before you see it on NYU classes because it probably won't be till Wednesday but that they record it. But sometime tomorrow, you will get the emails. Okay. So, any other questions? So here's what we're going to return to where we were. And as I said, if you remember, we were talking about growth rates. Seems way back in time, but we're talking about growth rates, folks. Come on. We were talking about growth rates, and we were talking about looking at how much a company reinvests and how well it reinvests, and that neat little equation that tied growth to a reinvestment rate and a return on capital. I'm going to break that neatness down today, because that equation that we looked at, it's called a fundamental or an intrinsic growth equation, works when your company is stable, has margins that are going to be constant over time, returns on capital that don't change over time. And there are very few companies that meet those requirements. So I want to talk in a more general case about what to do when you have margins changing and returns on capital changing. Because here's what's going to happen. When your return on capital itself is changing, you're going to be able to grow without reinvesting sometimes. And let's take a very simple example. Let's suppose you have a company which has a 5% return on capital, which reinvests absolutely nothing, but improves the return on capital from 5% to 10%. What's that company's growth rate going to be? It is reinvesting zero, right? So if we use the equation, reinvestment zero, the growth should be zero, but the return on capital went from 5 to 10%. Somebody help me. What will the growth rate for this company be? Last year, how much did it make? $5 million on our $100 million in invested capital. This year, how much is it making? $10 million. Your income goes from 5 to 10, you're going to get 100% growth rate. This is called efficiency growth. Efficiency growth doesn't require reinvestment. It means improving how you use your assets. And when you have assets that are improving, you can get the efficiency growth driving your growth rate high, at least for a period. So I'm going to use an example. This is a company you've looked at already when we talked about historical growth. It's Motorola. I was valuing Motorola in 1999. Its return on capital was 12.18%. Its reinvestment rate was 53%. If I just stopped there and said, what's the growth rate going to be for Motorola? You'd multiply 12 by 53%, you get a growth rate of 6% plus. And we did that. But let's say that I'm more optimistic about Motorola in the future. And I say, look, I think Motorola's return on capital is going to improve from 12% to 17% over the next 5 years. Think about it. If your return on capital goes from 12 to 17, that's going to be a growth rate by itself of about 40%, right? That 5% over 12 gives you about 40%. But it's going to happen over 5 years. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take first the assumption that on the new investments, they will make the higher return on capital. So the first term is my fundamental growth equation. 17% times 53% is my growth rate. The second term in the equation is the efficiency growth. As I go from 12 to 17%, I'm computing how much my growth rate will be higher each year. And guess what? Each year, I will add about 8% more to my growth rate because I'm improving return on capital. I'm trying to give a way out for some of you who are working with mature companies with terrible returns on capital. Some of you pick bad companies. They're in bad businesses. They're earning 4 or 5% return on capital. If you earn a 4 or 5% return on capital, you can already see that giving them a high growth rate with the old equation is not going to give you a high number, because with a low return on capital, your growth is going to be low, unless you believe the company will improve its return on capital from whatever it is today to some higher number. So in general, when you think about growth, you've got growth from reinvestment and growth from efficiency. The sum of those two numbers will be the growth rate for your company. So I'm going to give you five different companies, all with the same growth rate. And I have a very simple task for you. All of them look the same in terms of growth, but I want you to rank these companies from the most valuable growth. Because remember, growth can have high value, it can have no value, it can actually have negative value. I want you to rank these companies from highest value growth to lowest value growth. So the first company has a reinvestment rate of 20% and a return on capital of 50%. Its growth rate is 20 times 50, 10%. The second company has a reinvestment rate of 100%, return on capital of 10%, has a growth rate of 10% as well. The third company has a return on capital of 200%, a reinvestment rate of 200%, a return on capital of 5%, 200% times 5% is 10% as well. Companies 4 and 5 have reinvestment rates of pretty low, but they get improvement in their existing return on capital. All five companies have exactly the same 10% growth rate. So if you look at them in terms of growth, they all look the same, right? But I'm going to argue that if you look across these companies, some of these companies have very valuable growth, some have no value growth, and some have negative value growth. And I'm going to give you the variable that will let you differentiate across them. They all have a 10% cost to capital. What's the cost of capital? It's what you need to make on projects to break even. So let's start easier. Which of these companies is just running in place? It's growing, but it's not adding absolutely no value. I have 5, 3, 2, might as well complete the spectrum, 4 and 1, let me throw in there too. What's the definition of creating no value? You earn a return on capital equal to your cost of capital. You're growing, but you're not adding value, you're not destroying value. Company 2 is just running in place. It's growing, but it's earning a return on capital exactly equal to the cost of capital. So that's your zero value company. Which is the company that has that's creating the highest value? You're getting a 10% growth rate for company 1, but it's doing very little reinvestment. Do you see the benefit of investing in company 1? You're going to get a 10% growth rate, and you're going to be able to collect this huge cash flow. So in terms of the most value growth, company 1 is best, because it creates the same growth rate with a lot less reinvestment. Company 3 is the worst, because you're getting a 10% growth rate, but how is it doing it? Taking terrible projects. And companies 4 and 5 are going to look good for a year, but then they're going to bounce back to a much lower growth rate. So they've been nice for a year, but not for the long term. All I'm trying to say is we treat high growth companies as winners without even looking under the surface. You can be a high-growth company and a really good company, a high-growth company and a neutral company, and a high-growth company that's a bad company. But to make that differentiation, you have to look past the growth rate, what kind of return on capital they're making and how much they're reinvesting. That's why in all of the valuations we've done so far, I emphasize that reinvestment part as much as I do the growth. It's easy to grow, but it's really difficult to grow without reinvesting a lot of money. And that combination is what drives the value of growth. So that's one perspective on growth. Basically, we're building it up to growth based on how much a company reinvests and how well it reinvests. A lot of companies, though, when you think about growth, you have to come from the top down. What do I mean? You have to start with revenues and work down. Take a company like Casper. What's the return on capital for Casper right now? You don't have to give me a number. Positive or negative? It's a big negative number. What's its reinvestment rate? Big negative number, because the denominator is negative. You're saying this is very convenient. Big negative times big negative is big positive. But that doesn't help you with Casper, because they're already losing money. So with Casper, what do I have to do? I have to grow the revenues first. Then I have to map out a pathway for the margins to improve over time, because the margins stay negative, they're sunk. And finally, I've got to close the loop by saying how much will they need to reinvest to get those plans for revenue growth to come to fruition. This is exactly how I did Tesla, right? I start with revenues first, then I work to a margin, and then I said, how much will I need to reinvest, using that sales to invested capital as my proxy for how much you're reinvesting. You're already seeing the levers that I would use in any generic valuation. So let's look at how this would play out. And I'm going to go back in time to July of 2015 to another Tesla valuation, an earlier point in time. At the time that I valued them, the revenues were $2 billion. There was time. Today, the revenues are $25 billion. So July 2015, the revenues were $2 billion. And I faced a challenge. I had to make the small revenues into big revenues and their losses into profits. So here's the first step. I projected out revenues and I gave them luxury automobile revenues. My story in 2015 for Tesla was going to be a luxury auto company. That story has obviously shifted more towards the mass market, especially with the Tesla 3 and the $35,000 Tesla 3, which never came to fruition, but at least there's talk of making a mass market auto. So if you think about the revenue growth, my revenue growth is tailored to give them revenues that reflect a luxury auto company, $79 billion. $2 billion becomes $79 billion. That's a pretty optimistic path, right? We'll come back and deal with whether it's optimistic or not, but that's my revenues growing. Their margins right now are negative. If they stay negative, we know exactly what Tesla's worth. It's worth nothing. So I have to improve margins. And the question I faced was, what do the margins look like? I gave them margins at the 75th percentile of the automobile business then. How has that story changed? In my 2019 valuation of Tesla, I've actually made them a kind of melded auto tech company. But in 2015, I viewed them as an automobile company, so I picked the margin. And then I moved the margins from where they are today to 12%. You're saying, how did you come up with those intermediate numbers? You know, if you look at the improvements over time, basically I'm actually taking steps which, if you work them down, are pretty close to linear. I'm just going from where it is now to 12%. I'm taking the difference and dividing by 10. You're saying that's so unsophisticated. I agree. If you want to play with this, remember, it's not going to affect your valuation that much. I'll give you ways. This is called the pathway to profitability. So when we get closer to this and start valuing young companies, we'll talk about why the pathway might be rockier for some companies and what the mechanism for adjusting this. So in this table, what do we have? Small revenues becoming big revenues and losses becoming profits. It's so easy to do on a spreadsheet. Much more difficult to do in practice, actually, running a company. But on a spreadsheet, I can make any company look substantial and profitable. The loose end here, though, is to make my revenues go from $2 billion to $79.6 billion. Remember, Tesla has to sell almost 1.5 million cars to get to 79. Its capacity right now is only, at least in July 2015, was about 250,000 cars. So what's the final loose end? I've got to come up with how much they will need to reinvest. And this is what I did. I basically took the change in revenues every year, which I had projected based on my projections. And I said, well, how much will they need to reinvest to get that change in revenues? And in July of 2015, I still viewed Tesla primarily as an automobile company. That 1.55 that you see there is what a typical automobile company has to invest to get. So a typical automobile company to get $1.55 in revenues has to invest a dollar in invested capital. So here's how it works. Take the change in revenue in year one, $1.309 billion. You divide by 1.55, there's my reinvestment. What goes into reinvestment? CapEx, working capital, R&D, acquisitions. You're saying, why aren't you breaking it down? Why am I not breaking it down? I don't know where the reinvestment is going to come from. Elon Musk doesn't know where the reinvestment is going to come from. Why would I put this hat on saying I'm going to break it down when nobody really knows? This much I know, for them to grow as much as I'm projecting them to grow, they will have to reinvest a lot of money. I just have no idea in what. And ultimately, it's the cash flow that matters. So that reinvestment becomes what I subtract out. So basically, I have revenues, I have operating income. You're saying, how come I'm not paying taxes in the first year? It's because you're losing money. But even when they're making money, it doesn't look like they're paying taxes almost until, year four. So why aren't they paying taxes in the first 3 years? We talked about this. You have a money-losing company, what happens? Your NOL grows as you lose money. So initially, at least, those NOLs are protecting them. And then finally, they start to pay taxes. So you have after-tax operating income minus reinvestment. And do you see what the free cash flows look like in my optimistic story? This is a company that's going to burn through cash, at least my July 2015 story, like nobody's ever burned through cash. It's going to have 9 years of negative cash flows, even though their margins turn positive. Why? Because I'm mapping out this incredibly ambitious growth plan for them. This is the dark side of having companies that explode in growth, is there's going to be a reinvestment that drains your cash flows. Eventually, the company becomes a regular company, right, with operating income and reinvestment. But what I'm doing on the sheet is mapping out that pathway to get there. So in summary, I know some of you are valuing young companies. Do it in three steps. First, you've got to tell a story about revenues and what you think they will do over time. Second, you've got to tell a story about margins and how they will improve over time. And third, you have to tell a story about reinvestment and tie it to your growth rate. And those stories will all come together in your numbers. And are those numbers going to come through? Not, in fact, you know with certainty you're going to be wrong. But all you can do is make the best judgments you can given what you know today. So if you ask me to summarize all of the different ways of thinking about growth, you can look at historical growth. We talked about what the problem with historical growth is. It's not a good predictor of future growth. You can outsource it and ask managers or analysts what they think the growth rate is. But the problem is they're not very good at forecasting growth. Or you can take responsibility to estimate growth and tie growth to how much you reinvest and how well you reinvest. But if your margins are changing, you have to bring in an efficiency component. But most generally, if you have to value a company, you can start with revenue growth, then move to margins, and move to reinvestment. Which one will be right for your company? I don't know, because it'll depend on the company. But at least you have a menu of choices you can look at. And my suggestion is, why not look at all the choices before you decide which one is right for you? Because I can't prejudge what will work for you. Any questions about growth? I know the quiz has kind of left you shell-shocked. Okay? It's okay. It's just a quiz. It too will pass, right? So by tomorrow, it'll start to become something you look at your rearview mirror. Today, it's too raw. I won't go there. No. So let's talk about the final piece in every valuation. We talked about cash flows. We talked about discount rates. We talked about growth rates. But remember I said the value of an asset is the present value of the expected cash flows on that asset. And if you're a company, I said, that company could last forever. And you can't estimate cash flows forever. So when you see discounted cash flow valuations, here's what you will tend to see. You will see people estimating cash flows in the next 3 years, the next five, the next 10. At the end of the 10th year, they will estimate what's called a terminal value. Why? Because they're tired. They want to get done. And the question is, how do you come up with a terminal value? And it's a big deal because that number by far is the biggest number in your valuation. So I'll give you three ways in which you can estimate the terminal value, one of which should never be used but gets used all the time. And the other two are legitimate contenders. The first way you can get terminal value is to have a liquidation value. Basically, at the end of year 5 or year 10, you say, I'm done. I'm going to liquidate the assets. And that's perfectly consistent with the discounted cash flow model. Why? Because we have a company with a finite life. You have a mine that you own. At the end of the 10 years, there's nothing left. It's just a hole in the ground. There's no terminal value forever. That's why when I valued Aramco, at the end of 50 years, what was my end terminal value? There's nothing. Because once the oil is out of the ground, what are you going to pay for? Sand? I mean, that's what's going to be left, right? In fact, you might have a stretch of liabilities that you might have to deal with in terms of cleaning up if you're in some other market, but Aramco can probably walk away from all those empty, you know, whatever they leave. So liquidation value is okay. Obviously, assuming a growth rate in perpetuity has to be okay because it is a discounted cash flow model, though it does make assumptions about the company continuing. So already I've kind of given you the answer as to when you should, which approach you should never use, which is you estimate the terminal value at the end of year 10 by using a multiple. If any of you have worked at a bank, this is how 80% of discounted cash flow valuations in banks are done. You project out the cash flows for the next 10 years, and at the end of the 10th year, you apply a multiple to EBITDA, 6 times EBITDA, 8 times earnings, 2 times book value. You think, what's wrong with that? Where do you get those numbers? And he says 6 times EBITDA. The banker says, use 6 times EBITDA in year 10 for this company. Where does that 6 times EBITDA come from? It could be from the guy who used it before, or it can be looking at the peer group and seeing what they trade at, right? Which is really pricing. If your biggest number in your DCF is a pricing, then it's no longer a DCF. It's a DCF. I call these Trojan horse valuations. Remember the legend of the Trojan horse? You don't? I'll tell you the story. It's actually a fun story. It might take your mind off the quiz. So about several thousand years ago, people had nothing to do. There was no Netflix, no TV. So what do? They fought multi-year war. So the Greeks and the Trojans have this like 50-year war going on. So as part of this war, the Greeks surround this Trojan town. And they put it under siege. So years of siege. And so you're a Trojan. Think like a Trojan. You've been trapped in this town for the last 7 years. You haven't been able to visit your relatives for a while. And then the Greek head of the military comes to you and says, would you like a gift? Let me ask you a question. You've been under siege for 5 years. The Greek army says, would you like a gift? What's your reaction? You should be a little skeptical. The Trojans were not. That's the reason there's no long history of the Trojans. They obviously were not that bright. So they say, okay, we'd love a gift. And the Greek army gives them a gift of this big wooden horse, huge. Now, what do you do with a big wooden horse? I don't know. But the Trojans, as I said, were not very bright. So the Greeks wheel in this big wooden horse into this Trojan town. The Trojans shut the gate then and said, well, those nice Greeks, they're not that bad. And in the middle of the night, the back of the wooden horse opens up, and all these Greek soldiers who were inside the horse come out of the horse, and the town falls. Hence the saying, beware of Greeks bearing gifts. Okay? You're saying, what's this got to do with valuation? So when you do a DCF, what do? You're focused on cash flows in year one, year two, year three. And while I'm focused on your cash flows in the next 10 years, what do? You open the back of the DCF, and you put 6x EBITDA, and it slips out. You've essentially taken over my DCF. If you see a DCF where your terminal values are pricing, you might have, if you're the low person in the totem pole there, don't speak up, don't do something stupid. But this is not the way you should be doing an intrinsic valuation. So here's what I'd like to talk about. I'd like to talk about using one of the two approaches that are okay, right? Either liquidation value or terminal growth. But I'm going to talk about one of the reasons why bankers are worried about terminal growth models. They claim that you can get explosive values and strange things can happen. But I'm going to impose some rules on terminal value that are going to keep you on the reservation, keep you from doing weird things. So in the terminal growth equation, here's what you do. You project out cash flows in the next 10 years. At the end of the 10th year, you stop and you assume your cash flows will grow at a constant rate forever. You know what that buys you? It buys you an infinite series in mathematics. And in that infinite series, that terminal value can be written as your cash flows 1 year after. That's always the case. So to get the terminal value in year 10, I always have to do cash flows in year 11 and divide by the difference between my discount rate and the growth rate. This is the most deadly equation in all of finance because you can do some really serious damage to yourself with this equation. And let's see why. Look at the denominator. What do you have? R minus G, right? So let's say you sit down to do a valuation. You use a G of 1.5%, and you come up with too low a number. You know what I mean by too low a number? Remember I said most valuation, you start with a number in your head, and you want to get there. 1.5% gave you too low a number. So here's what you do. You take the 1.5, and you make it 1.7. Then you make it 2. Then you make it 2. And as you're doing this, what's happening? R minus G is getting smaller. And if you don't stop, you're going to have what I call Buzz Lightyear valuations. Because as G approaches R, what happens to your terminal value? To infinity and beyond. So I would get a Buzz Lightyear figure, put it right in front of you, and say, I don't want to be like Buzz. So when you use that growth rate forever, it comes with a cap, right? Because if you have a company growing at a fixed rate forever, that growth rate cannot exceed the growth rate of the economy in which you operate. Why? Because if you let it grow at a rate faster than the economy, your company will become the economy. Then what? Globalization. Okay, keep going. About 25 years later, it'll be the global economy. Then what? You kind of keep hitting caps. This is one of those things where there is no room to compromise. You say, can I set the growth rate just a little bit over the growth rate of the economy? No. That's like being a little bit pregnant. It doesn't quite work. This is one of those 0-1 things. You either broke the rules or you did not. You're either pregnant or you're not. You either broke the rules or you're not. This one, don't mess with it. You just have to. And I'm actually going to impose a very simple proxy for growth rate in the economy. Because otherwise, you're going to be asking economists what the growth rate is, and they have no idea what they're talking about anyway. The proxy I'm going to use is the risk-free rate. And think of why. What goes into risk-free rate? Expected inflation plus an expected real interest rate. Remember I showed you that graph of intrinsic risk-free rates? This is actually terrible news if you're valuing a U.S. company. Remember I told you that change was coming at the start of the semester? And one of the changes is, of course, last week was a kind of mind-blowing change. It was a test of your faith. But what happened to the T-bond rate over the course of the week? In fact, it's hit 1%. Which means if you're valuing a company in U.S. dollars, what have I just told you? That your growth rate in perpetuity is going to be capped at 1%. You're saying, this is not fair. Hey, you weren't complaining about what was fair when you used the 1% as your risk-free rate when you did your cost of capital and came up with a really low number. It is to keep balance that I'm going to do it. So I'm going to argue that your risk-free rate is a good proxy for the nominal growth rate in the economy because embedded in the risk-free rate, inflation and real interest rate. In fact, I'll back it up with some empirical backing. If you go back in time and you look at the risk-free rate at the start of each period and what the actual growth rate was in the U.S. economy over the period, the best predictor of U.S. economic growth for much of the last 50 years has not been some super macroeconomist sitting somewhere. It's been the T-bond rate. At the start of every decade, you look at the T-bond rate, look at the growth rate of the day. So this is both a pragmatic choice and one that takes a huge load off my shoulders because I'm not sitting there saying, well, what growth rate can I use? It also means that if you do your valuation in a different currency, Indonesian rupiah, you get a little more leeway for your growth rate, right? Why? Because you have a higher risk-free rate. You're saying, good, let me value every company in rupiah. Remember, what one hand gives you, the other hand will take away. The same forces that allow you to use a higher growth rate will also allow you to use a higher discount rate. So what we're trying to do is stay consistent. And the argument for using the risk-free rate as a proxy for long-term growth both comes from the underlying fundamentals as well as the empirical reality that it is a pretty good predictor of long-term growth of the economy. So I would argue that rather than sit there asking yourself what will the economy grow at and second-guessing yourself, that you basically take the risk-free rate, use it as a cap, because implicitly you're making assumptions about the future of the economy with your risk-free rate, and you're trying to be consistent to make the same assumptions of you in the numerator. One reason the last decade has been really tough on people doing DCF valuations is they're continuing to use growth rates from their past. So 20 years ago, the conventional wisdom was the U.S. economy grows at about 2% in real terms. You had a 2% inflation rate. We'll use a 4% growth rate. And they continue to use the 4% growth rate while lowering the risk-free rate from 3 to 2 to 1.5%. And you can already see that if you use a 4% growth rate for every numerator and you cap your risk-free rate 1.5%, your valuation is destined to implode. So that's the first thing. When you get to that terminal value and I ask you what your growth rate is, I'm asking you to hang yourself by making the wrong choice. In fact, many of my spreadsheets, I lock you into using the risk-free rate because I don't want you to make that choice. But now at least, if I ask you to make the choice, you have a sense of why you want to stay constrained. Any questions about your growth rate forever? Yeah.
How do you know what the risk-free rate will be 10 years?
Then use a different risk. So if you think it's going to be 3% and you decide to change your risk-free rate to 3%, you could use the forward markets. We can ask that about how do we know what our margins will be in year five? So don't even start with that. We don't know. But if you believe that rates today are too low and they're going to climb in the next 10 years and you want to use 3%, your risk-free rate will be 3%, your growth rate will be 3%, and guess what your terminal value will look like? Pretty much what it was if you left it at 1%. This is the great thing about tying the two is whatever you change in one will also happen the other, which saves me a huge amount of headaches, right? I'm not sitting there, what will the T-bond rate be 10 years from now? Because it's a distraction. I want to value Casper or Tesla, not get focused on the risk-free rate 10 years from now. But you're free to do that, but then make sure your growth rate also adjusts. Don't wait too long to put your company into stable growth because, you know, many people say, I have a high-growth company. Can I wait 25 years? Can I wait 50 years? No. So when you sit down to value a high growth company, let me ask you a question. You know, let's say it's Casper, right? Lots of potential. And I ask you to set a growth period, less than 5 years, 5 years, 10 years, more than 10 years. What's your first instinct? It's a high growth company, you want to go with 20 years, 25 years, 30 years. Well, the answer to this is an empirical question. How long does growth last at growth companies? And there is actually some research that shows what the typical growth period is for a growth company. And this is for one of my most depressing graphs, if you're a growth investor, because it looks at... the graph is not there. Okay, never mind. No, it'll be later in the slide somewhere. But it actually looks at young companies and how long they grow. You know what the median growth period for a growth company is? About 3 to 5 years. So when you use... I've never used more than 10 years in a DCF. And people say, well, how come you don't use 25 years? And they name companies that have grown for longer than 10 years. And you can name some of them, right? Microsoft, Apple, Facebook, Google. What does the fact that you can name companies that have grown for long periods tell you about these companies? They're the exception, not the rule. If I value every company to be the exception, I'm begging for trouble. To meet, if I get to 10 years and you keep growing, it's icing on the cake and I want to keep it, not hand it over to whoever's selling me the stock. So that's why I stop at 10 years, not because I'm being unrealistic and expect no company to ever grow longer than 10 years, but because I think I'm already at the 90th percentile of growth periods, and I would stop there. And one of the factors that determines how long I will allow a company to grow is how strong its competitive advantages are. That corporate strategy class finally can come to some use, because I'm sure you talked about all of the potential competitive advantages, right? Brand name, economies of scale. Here's where you bring that to use. If you have a company with strong and sustainable competitive advantages, you can let it grow for a much longer time period than if you have a company that does not have those advantages. So if you thought valuation was just about the numbers and you could stay on a spreadsheet, you got to forget that, because you got to step back and ask those questions. They're qualitative questions about that competitive advantage, because the stronger and more sustainable your competitive advantage is, the longer your growth period can be. One of the reasons when I first valued Groupon, I gave them only a 3-year growth period, even though they were a high growth company, is I could not think of any strong and sustainable competitive advantages that they have. So when you look at Casper, that's a question I would ask myself. And this makes me, if I were an investor in Casper, it would be the one that worries me the most. What's its competitive advantage? It can't be better mattresses. Why not? Because they don't even make their own mattresses. The manufacturers of their mattresses actually make the mattresses for Lisa and 3 other competitors. So it can't be the quality of the mattress, because it's the same foam mattress. Could it be economies of scale? If you don't make your own mattresses, what economies of scale? It can't be that. Right now, their only competitive advantage is they're a really clever marketing company. I still remember that. I mean, 8 years ago, if you took the subway in New York City, you saw a Casper ad, right? In fact, I think they have an actual store right on Broadway. You can walk over there. Walk in, don't buy anything. I had to buy a pillow when I got my apartment here, and I walked in there and said, a pillow costs almost as much as a mattress. I said, I'm not buying a pillow here. I lie on rocks, right? But it's a clever marketing company. And my concern with clever marketing is not it's a strong competitor, but it's not sustainable. Why? It's built on people and ideas, and people and ideas can leave. So think about what makes your company special, because that's going to give you at least a sense of how long growth can continue. I know you're reaching the end of your tether, so just one more slide and we'll be done. You get to your 10. And you tell your company, you set your company down and say, it's a stable growth company. So you give it a growth rate, which is reasonable. Let's say it's 2% or 1% a year forever. Don't forget everything we talked about in the context of growth. To grow, what does a company have to do? It has to reinvest. And now that you're in the terminal value stage of your calculation, you can no longer assume efficiency growth. Why not? Because a company can't stay efficient forever. It can't keep creating growth from efficiency. So it has to come from reinvestment. So here, that equation that we came up with, where we said the growth for a company is the return on capital times the reinvestment rate, becomes the equation that has to hold. So if you have a company that's going to grow 1% a year forever, and it has a 10% return on capital, guess how much it has to reinvest every year starting in year 10? To get a 1% growth with a 10% return on capital, 1 divided by 10 is 10%, your reinvestment rate has to be 10%. If that same company has a 5% return on capital, to grow at 1% a year, it'll have to reinvest 20%. If it has a 20% return on capital, it can reinvest 5%. This is how we reward good or bad and punish bad companies in your terminal value calculation. I'm going to send you a weekly challenge, which I'm sure none of you will try because you're sick and tired of valuation, and I don't blame you. But if you do get a chance, try it, because it's about computing terminal value and changing your growth rate, because it'll challenge the conventional wisdom that if you raise the growth rate, the terminal value always goes up. So I will see you on Wednesday, but watch for the email tomorrow. And once it comes, the quizzes will be out. You can pick them up and do what you want. Specifically in class, right? What do we say? What's working capital in class? Take a look at the notes, because that's accurate. We've actually spent about 10 minutes in class talking about why cash should never be included in working capital. Never be included.
Oh, so that assumption was correct then.
So you took cash out.
I didn't know whether I know to not use, a non-conversion cash for capital. I didn't do that. Right. But I didn't know if the one that was listed was non-cash or included cash.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So I assumed that the working capital then was listed.
Did you write it?
I wrote it.
Okay, then I'll
be
fine.
Should I mention custom world where asset is people? So the growth is a human and this going to be sustainable.
It's not even people. It's a marketing team. It might not even be in-house for all you know. It might be a very clever advertising agency.
So how about consulting companies
Different, right? Casper is not even people. It's a marketing team. With McKinsey, it's obviously people.
People and ideas.
So what's the point?
You said people and ideas can grow. So their growth rates are not sustainable.
So if you're a McKinsey and you want to make yourself valuable, what do you have to do? You have to create an infrastructure that is, in fact, something your people need to create value. That if you went off and worked for KPMG, you can't create the same value. It can come from the fact that your client list is much more lucrative. So the same person at KPMG can have exactly the same skills, but they can't reach the same kinds of companies. It could be that you have a database you've accumulated over time, or what you've, and this is something consulting firms have to remember, is if you can collect what you know, have learned over 50 years of consulting, and create kind of a shared knowledge base, it can't walk up. So if you're a consulting firm and you ask me, how do I keep value up? I say, definitely it's not from just hiring the most expensive consultants and letting them be free agents, because then you're asking for trouble. This is exactly the problem investment banks had, right? They decided that money was the only thing you want to compete on. So guess what started happening? Traders just went to the highest bidder. If you bid for human capital and you let it go to the highest bidder, there goes your excess return out of the door. So good consulting firms, the consultants are a critical part, but they're also creating an infrastructure that makes those consultants more valuable within their infrastructure than elsewhere.
So part of it comes.
So basically, even if they leave, they're not taking the entire growth from it. So. Whereas there are some consulting firms that are just a collection of smart consultants, right? There's nothing holding them together. Those consulting firms can be very, this often law firms this happens, right? Where you have a very lot of successful lawyers, but there's nothing holding them together. So when the lawyers leave or die, the law firm just basically crumbles. And law firms often can go from being very successful law firms to basically dust if the people leave. So the very best consulting firms, the McKinseys and the Bains, tend to be more than just a collection of consultants. The human capital matters, but the human capital in conjunction with what they offer. So, exactly. The technology is less so, right? Technology you can buy. It's got to, that's why it's kind of, you got to create a culture. It's got to be shared knowledge. It's got to be something more than, we've got big computers and smart consultants. But then I'm going to say, that's nice, I'll give you value while they last. But guess what they're going to do? They're going to keep looking for a higher bidder, and they're going to go to somebody who pays them more. And you don't have a strong and sustainable competitor. I'll give you 3 years of good revenues and income, but then I'm going to fade it down very quickly because you're competitive. So not all consulting firms are built in. Hi. So you're Lena?
Yes.
Yeah?
Nice to meet you.
Yeah.
Can you make it? on the folder.
E-L-I-N-A, right?
Elena, yeah, Elena.
E-L-E-N-A or E-L-I-N?
E.
L. I or E?
L.
Yeah, I got the L.
I.
And
I have a question, like, this lecture is graded.
It's the same thing. I teach the same class with the MBAs as well.
And this is finance major, right? The finance major.
No, it doesn't work.
Because finance is undergraded. I noticed that I don't have a lot of data. We are talking about personal finance, personal financial planning, and it's not a global.
This is evaluation class.
This is evaluation class.
So usually it's the third or fourth or fifth. What's the sequence? You take foundations first?